Blog Talk Radio.
Radio Freemason, and I'm your host for the next little while, Dale Graham. Thank you for coming back if you're a longtime visitor, and if you're new to the show, welcome. A bit of things relevant to Freemasons, a bit entertaining, a bit informative, and we always try to be topical. This is the 229th day of the year. It means there's not a whole lot of time left in the year when you think about it. Today, we're just carrying on, lingering over the 100th anniversary, I guess, of the commemorative to fellows and women that participated in the First World War. It's not something we walk around. It's like a bit like masonry in a way. It's not something we walk around thinking about every single moment of every single day. Don't be ridiculous, but there are times when it's when you know we need to teach our children just what the history of mankind, humanity includes. It hasn't always been pretty, has it? We live in such abundance and freedoms, but every freedom and everything that we have around us was had a price, and it was some very horrible, horrible acts, and a great deal of blood was shed to get what we have. Hard to believe that we would want to ever give it up or give it away, you know, without fighting for it and protecting the dignity of those people that made an incredible effort. We're going to have some interesting themes today, and I'm going to talk to you about the kind of music that was in the ears of people at the time, and I'm going to share with you soldiers were reading in the trenches. May surprise some of you. We live in a very strange time when you think about it historically, and you put it into some context. This sense of bravado is, and this notion of machoism seems to have been a product of maybe the 50s and 60s, and a movie that had the wrong impression, that left a really rather insulting impression on the on impressive minds, and about how a forthright and upright and strong man of conviction carries himself. Not some of the boyish antics we see around us today, of course. I'm not going to slag the political celebrities or the talking picture celebrities. not that long ago. And the episode today is about the craft it gives and it takes, sort of the price of Freemasonry. I'd like you to just think about it a bit. I have a little bit, an item that I think is kind of curious about the nature of the Entered Apprentice. And it made me stop and think. This one's by Manly P. Hall, a Canadian guy, writing. Of course, he was sensible enough to head for California and write, I guess. I don't know if he lived to see what was going on today. Or anyway, he raises some interesting and thoughtful points. So, it made me stop and think whether I'll ever successfully resolve the training of being an Entered Apprentice. And for those of you who may be guests of Freemasonry, we're going to be sharing the idea. If you're curious about what a Freemason is, it's exactly the kind of question we're going to bring up today. Only we'll put a little bit of a Masonic spin, what makes us a Freemason. And I think in some ways what the ingredients that makes a person a Freemason goes beyond the ritual of Freemasonry. It's out there in the world. And there are a lot of very, very honorable, very forthright people that are an absolute pleasure to know who aren't Freemasons. So we embrace the philosophies and principles of that we know as Freemasonry that exist everywhere around us. And in fact, a well-versed and well-skilled apprentice in Freemasonry will always look for those principles in the hearts and minds and the actions of the people around. But foremost in his own behavior, in his own mind, in his own action. The Isle of Crete was the location of one of the first major cultures that grew to significance about 4,000 years ago. We know that culture as the Minoans. Mm-hmm. Along with giving us the day off, Minoans gave us that. And before that, you worked. Minoa may be able to give Freemasons answers to the ancient and nature and future of the culture of Freemasonry and how it will revolve. You know, study what happened before. In exchange for giving us metals and materials we can manufacture into goods, the earth extracts a price. That price is what we call pollution. What I call pollution. The world of Freemasonry is different than it was in the beginning. We often can't determine specific line points, but we have enough context that gives us some reliable suppositions. Our history was less Big Bang and more molecular. What we know as the practice of Freemasonry came about over time, influenced by social change, invention, history, and evolution of science and ideas. But with that growth, Freemasonry did not absorb every idea nor reduce every question into useful information. Conspiracy theories struggling to influence evolution of the fraternity, a sense that it can be influenced, all of this is the flotsam and jetsam hitting the shores of Freemasonry. There are many Freemasons who are sure the obsession with the drop in membership numbers is worth the worry. There are some who even trifle with it out of a belief Masonic thought has become constitutional system of governance. Freemasonry is a doctrine, but at the front edge is a dilettante soul. It doesn't need protection, but the apprentices do. We need the organization. We need the contract. We need exposure to scholarship to achieve the goals. Freemasonry is elemental. It existed before 1717. It cannot be destroyed by despots and maniacs. If we could advertise intelligence, we could advertise Freemasonic thought. But that, as we know, only comes when ability, effort, and maturity are combined. And that's the stuff we call happiness. A little tune for you. You know, we're always floating back and forth in time. Here's a music from the ancient Greeks. Listen to what there are thousands and thousands of Greeks, yeah? But we know the highlights of their history and the highlights of the minds, the great minds. And here's what, I don't know if you call it a toe tapper. It's called the Dance of Satyrs. That's what happens when this is music. It's kind of interesting, I thought. It's the music is ancient Greek, but the players are Macedonian and Greek. You know, everybody likes to have that provenance in the background, hey? And mind if I throw out a few, I think, useful quotes today? This is from Alfred Lord Tennyson, a skilled orator. It says, better to have loved and lost than never to have loved at all. That was Al's thought. You know, thanks, Al. We've often licked our wounds and said that. No man ever got high by pulling other people down. The intelligent merchant does not knock his competitors. The sensible worker does not work those who work with him. Don't knock your friends. Don't knock your enemies. And don't knock yourself. There. Music of the First World War. Yeah. I think you'll find that's a kind of familiar. Very, very familiar. And not that long ago.
My voice has come.
what's the use of worrying? You imagine. Imagine. It's not going to matter whether you worry yourself sick, you shake yourself to sleep with anxiety. Life goes on. Such was the life in the trench. It's rather daunting. Here, I'm going to start reading this before I tell you who wrote it. This was one of the books that was handed around the trenches when the men had downtime. They liked to read. Eleanor and Marianne Dashwood, together with their mother and younger sister, are left homeless when their father dies at the family estate, Norland Park in Sussex, passes to their half-brother, Mr. John Dashwood. The new heir and his wife are cold and miserly. They ignore old Mr. Dashwood's request to provide for his wife and daughters. Mrs. Dashwood and her daughters take a cottage in Devon on the estate of their cousin, Sir John Middleton. Marianne, a passionate romantic, despairs at ever finding true love. There is a mutual attraction between Eleanor and Edward Ferrars, the brother of her sister-in-law, Mrs. John Dashwood. His sister does not approve, nor does his overbearing mother. Before leaving Norland, Eleanor notices a coolness in Edward's manner towards her. Life in Devon is quiet but comfortable. The Dashwoods adjust to their reduced circumstances with good grace. Sir John is a friendly man with an endless supply of guests at his home, Barton Park. His wife, Lady Middleton, is an insipid woman, solely interested in her young children. The Dashwoods are frequently pressed to join in the activities at Barton Park. Mrs. Jennings, Lady Middleton's mother, was a good-humored, merry, fat, elderly woman who talked a great deal, seemed very happy and rather vulgar. She was full of jokes and laughter, and before dinner was over had many witty things on the subject of lovers and husbands, hoped that they had not left their hearts behind them in Sussex, and pretended to see them blush, whether they did or not. Marianne was vexed at it for her sister's sake and turned her eyes toward Eleanor to see how she bore these attacks, and with an earnestness that gave Eleanor far more pain that could arise from such commonplace raillery as Mrs. Jennings. Colonel Brandon, the friend of Sir John, seemed no more adapted by resemblance of manner to be his friend than Lady Middleton was to be his wife, or Mrs. Jennings to be Lady Middleton's mother. He was silent and grave. His appearance, however, was not unpleasing, in spite of his being, in the opinion of Marianne and Margaret, an absolute old bachelor, for he was on the wrong side of 50 and 30, but though his face was not handsome, his countenance was sensible, and his address was particularly gentlemanlike. There was nothing in any of the party which should recommend them as companions to the Dashwoods, but the cold insipidity of Melita Middleton was so particularly repulsive that in comparison of it, the gravity of Colonel Brandon and even the boisterous mirth of Sir John and his mother-in-law was interesting. Lady Middleton seemed to be roused to enjoyment only by the entrance of her four noisy children after dinner, who pulled her about, tore her clothes, and put an end to every kind of discourse except what related to themselves. In the evening, as Marianne was discovered to be musical, she was invited to play. The instrument was unlocked, everybody prepared to be charmed, and Marianne, who sang very well at their request, went through the chief of the songs which Lady Middleton had brought into the family on her marriage, and which perhaps has lain ever since in the same position on the pianoforte, for her ladyship had celebrated that event by giving up music, although by her mother's account she had played extremely well, and by her own was fond of it. Jane Austen. That's a small portion from the start of Sense and Sensibility. Sense and Sensibility. This is the work that the fellows in the trench tucked into their jackets. And when they had some time to rest or have a meal, This is what they pulled out. And when they were done, they passed it on to another fellow. What's it tell you? What's it tell you? How did it sound? Well, obviously, these men were reading about the lives back home. And not only the lives, the personalities, the character of people that were familiar to them in their own way. You know, Mrs. Jennings, Lady Middleton's mother, being good-humored, merry, fat, elderly woman who talked a great deal, seemed very happy and rather vulgar. Well, they knew her. They knew her in their own way. The emotional context that Jane Austen brought to her work helped to, helped to connect those fellows with a safer and better time in their lives, with people that mattered to them, people that were real. Not a bad way of escaping the insanity that they were living through. Sense and Sensibility was first published in 1811. And Austen had a number of books from that point on. In 1816, she wrote Emma. And then Northanger Abbey was in 1818. Pride and Prejudice, 1813. Mansfield Park in 1814. Persuasion in 1818. She was prolific. She was a prolific writer. So, when you think back, go to your used bookstore, pick up a copy of one of these classics, and read it for yourself. If you're interested in the mindset of the men, and think about the reality, which was the reality when they opened their eyes and saw the machine guns or the gas attacks or the barbed wire. Is that reality? What had prepared them? There were no videos, no historical documents, no films of Vietnam, none of that to prepare, even to have a sense of to see into the darkness, so that you didn't have to whistle so loudly when you walked through the cemetery. None of that. It was put on a uniform, be virtuous, think about your connection with your nation, all that rhetoric, and then step up to battle. Sort of the difference between what you're told it's about and the way it really is. It's essential, great, great battle, and the hope was that it was going to be fought and the lives would be sacrificed and that would be it. The world would never have to go through it again, but hindsight teaches us that perhaps in some ways it was not ended until 1946. But there was one continuous period of instability and threat and menace going on around the world until that came to an end. But do you mind a little bit of history? I love a little bit of history, wouldn't you? A little bit of something a little more, a little more, let's move ourselves out of that that reality. But let's remember that period and the detail and keep it in mind. Not to get maudlin, but to think about how it's that time and that history may have a bearing on the decisions that we make in our lives today. I mean, take us away from that. What could be more pleasant than I would talk to you about some bagpipe music? Of course, what could take you, who can dispel things? But the segue here is German bagpipe music. First World War, get it? Listen to this. This is from the Middle Ages.
Thank you.
German bagpipe music from the Middle Ages. Yeah, it gives us a bit of a bit better idea. Bagpipes were played all over the world. Here's a Slavonic bagpipe. Some of you may never have heard this. This is a medieval dance called Viprada. Anyway, we'll come back to that. Next, I'll give you a taste of a very, very interesting ancient bagpipe. It's called a piva, so long forgotten. It's a form of bagpipe. So we'll come back to that in a little bit. Here, a little bit on the Grand Lodge of Canada in Ontario. This is not the Grand Lodge of Canada. This is in the, you know, of ancient and accepted. This is the Grand Lodge of Canada in Ontario. This is written by the past Grand Senior, Grand Chapter, Scribe Ezra, the Grand Chapter. It's related that the founders of many of the early settlements on the coasts of and what are now familiarly known as the Maritime Provinces in Quebec were enterprising, adventurous, and wealthy French gentlemen. Huguenots as well as Catholics. Huguenots, the Protestant, of course. It is even stated that one of these, a certain Sieur de Mont, was the founder of Quebec City, the dependent giving only a second place to a compatriot, that fearless and gallant Champlain. The beauty and fertility of Acadia, Nova Scotia, appealed to the pioneer de Mont, who, after a coast voyage of discovery in 1604, landed on the shores of the Bay of Annapolis and there founded what was then called Port Royal and later Annapolis Royal. The historian further states that among the artificers brought out by the explorers were a number of the craft of operative masons, and that stones indented with peculiar marks have been found at various places and times. A letter now in the possession of the New England Historical Genealogical Society in Boston, written by Dr. Charles T. Jackson of that city, under date 2nd June 1856, states that while engaged in a geological survey of Nova Scotia in 1827, he discovered on the shore of Goat Island in Annapolis Basin a stone on which were rudely cut the square and compasses. And beneath them the figures 1606, all much weather-worn, but quite distinct. He carried the stone to Halifax, intending to send it to the Old Colony Pilgrim Society of Plymouth, Massachusetts, but instead left it with the late Chief Justice Halliburton, perhaps better known by his pen name, Sam Slick. In 1829, the judge published a work entitled Historical and Statistical Accounts of Nova Scotia, in which a description of the stone is given, and the writer there avers that it presented little indications of having been intended for any pretentious structure, as it was apparently of the rough ashlar variety, with no visible adherence of even an attempt at dressing. Its discovery, if it established nothing, provided material for an imaginative creation since and then. So remember, this went from finding it along the shore, and he discovered on the shore a stone. So this was the discovery out there. Its discovery was established, if it established nothing, provided material for much imaginative creation. Under British occupation, Annapolis became a military post. A fort was erected and garrisoned, and at the period when speculation deals with masonry's advent in that province, 1737-40, it was a place of considerable importance. To a British officer, Ensign Erasmus James Phillips of the 40th Regiment, nephew of Governor Phillips, is attributed the introduction of Freemasonry into Canada. Let me go over that just again. To a British officer, Ensign Erasmus James Phillips of the 40th Regiment, nephew of Governor Phillips, is attributed the introduction of Freemasonry into Canada. Attributed, there may have been others, but we're working with an attribute here. This brother was appointed Fort Major at Annapolis, and in that capacity was something of an administrator. As such, he had to periodically journey to headquarters at Boston and took advantage of one of the protracted visits to seek admission into the fraternity. And as the records show, received the degrees in the First Lodge in Boston in 1737. There is a fairly good local evidence as well as indirect documentary proof that he founded a lodge in Annapolis on his return, and that then or later he was clothed with authority by the provincial grandmaster at Boston, Henry Price, to act in a similar capacity for Nova Scotia. That this position was accepted as genuine is borne out by a letter directed to him from Halifax, dated the 12th June 1750, and signed by five influential brethren requesting his permission to establish a lodge there, with Governor Cornwallis as its head. Next year, a second lodge was formed at Halifax, and thereafter, down to 1791, the activity of the craft in that city was centered in three lodges. The authority vested in Phillips by Henry Price was confirmed by the Earl of Blessington, Grand Master of England in 1785, who signed a warrant constituting Erasmus James Phillips, Esquire, Provincial Grand Master of Nova Scotia and the territories thereunto belonging. Now, just to wrap it up, the only two lodges that appear to be traceable to Phillips' authority are those claimed to have been warranted at Annapolis in 1738 and at Halifax in 1750. The Annapolis Lodge, it is said, was removed to Halifax in 1749, becoming number one. There is no record, however, of its original working or subsequently, and although the Grand Lodge of Nova Scotia possesses much ancient and valuable manuscript in connection with early craft events in the province, the past, so far as Annapolis is concerned, is practically a blank. There will be no one to dispute Nova Scotia's just claim to the proud honor of being the first resting place of the Masonic banner in Canada, nor to deprive the memory of the soldier Mason, Brother Erasmus James Phillips, of the distinction of being its bearer. To quote a Massachusetts writer, "Our fraternity may well unite with the historian in the opinion that there are few localities in America around which the memories of the shadowy past more interestingly cluster than the ancient town of Annapolis." Notwithstanding the various fortunes and misfortunes which befell that locality, the Masonic fire smoldered there with singular persistency. The soldier and poet, the philanthropist, and the historian contributed each his share to draw Acadia and Massachusetts into very close relations for the next succeeding two centuries. There you have it. Little piece. This is from the history of Freemasonry in Canada, or what eminent Freemasons say of Freemasonry in Canada. Very, very old book, out of print. Compiled by Osborne Shepherd of Box 164, Hamilton. that this is just fascinating. This one I have is copyrighted in Ottawa, 15th November 1915, so just before the outbreak of the war. But I hope you found that interesting, useful. We can I can come back to that from time to time, I think. I think it will. Because the history that it captures explains a little bit. Haven't you heard that the first Masons here, funny, would this be politics? The first Masons here were soldiers that came in under a traveling warrant. And the idea is that those soldiers came to here in Ontario, and this is where it took root. Could it be that there's still that little bit of, back and forth, friendly, fraternal competition, that you have some, everybody would like to be first? Different ways, all based on different ways of looking at your history. If you're in the Maritimes, you're going to think, well, things came from the east, came across the Atlantic, relative east, came across the Atlantic and hit the Maritimes first. Well, truth be known, it did. And then to think that, is this plausible, that Phillips, we know we can trace that, the 18th century. I tell you the truth, it bores me when I hear these discussions about first. Bores me. I don't care. Truly. Love you as a brother, but I really don't care. It's the fact that we got here, that it started up in different places at different times, that's amazing. That's amazing. To draw a line and say I was here first. Well, if you're here first, then masonry in your area should be more developed than anywhere else, I would think. Or what have you been doing with all that time? I'd say that in a good-natured way. Of course it would. Be first, doesn't really matter. You can't prove it. Weren't there. Proof? Let the historians have at it. Oh, I know. That steps on the toes of a lot of the wee folk in Freemasonry. They think, you know, all those darn academics are just dissecting it. Well, that's what they do. Thank goodness they do. Here's that piece on the ancient bagpipe-like instrument. This is called a piva. And this came from research done old folk songs along the southern canton of Ticino. This is where a Swiss musician came across this ancient instrument. This guy's name is Ilario Garbani. You know, up in that, you know, where Switzerland Italy are the people are sort of back and forth, and the history is wonderfully cosmopolitan. Listen to the sound of this.
Look like. Da lì ho cominciato la mia storia che mi ha portato in Scozia.
My interest in bagpipes brought me to Scotland and to southern Italy. The principle of a bagpipe, no matter if it comes from southern Italy or Africa, is that you blow air into a bag, which you squeeze to produce a sound. Almost every bagpipe has a pipe producing a continuous tone, the so-called drone.
Drone in English. Oh, sempre questo suono.
South of Rome, you can find models with two chanters.
Modelli con due chanter.
Finding the original music played on the piva is more difficult than reconstructing the instrument. but some of the repertoire can be derived from old Ticino folk songs. They have the same limited tonal range as the piva, and their melodies harmonize with the drone. We have historical records from northern Italy, where a lot of research material was gathered on church bells. The churches in Bergamasco have 8 or 9 bells. The melodies played on those bells originated from bagpipes. Now, those melodies are coming back down from the church towers to be played again on the piva and other bagpipes. As a teacher, I naturally enjoy doing research. I once asked my pupils to go out and interview old people about forgotten songs. One girl returned with a song that was completely different from any Ticinese song I'd heard before. It was about a woman expressing her disappointment over her marriage, which is quite unusual, since women traditionally didn't have the courage to say such things. I then realized how much there was still to learn about Ticino.
C'erano molte cose ancora che non erano scoperte in Ticino.
Fascinating. Fascinating. Who's to say that the sciences can't help us out? Of course they can. Where did we get that arrogance? Where in the world? That's just staggering. That we're just that superior? Really? I just don't get it. Just don't see it. Although we can get up on our hind legs and bring that ignominious thinking to the forefront, but it really doesn't flatter us very much, and it's, I would say, kind of self-serving, don't you think? Epictetus taught us this. Science really is important to us, but he said only the educated are free. Epictetus, what are you saying? And that as an apprentice, as somebody that embraces a Masonic philosophy and is trying to understand it, that the only way I can be the free Mason is to use this opportunity to educate myself. Is that what you're saying? I also says, control thy passions, lest they take vengeance on thee. You know, like speaking before you think, speaking emotionally before you think, being rash, all the time, Epictetus. I absolutely understand. I absolutely understand. But this idea about education, are you telling me that Freemasonry takes down the barriers on the subject and says, have at it. If you want to find the stream of Masonry in that courses through your soul, you may do it by looking at the world in metaphysical terms or physics or philosophy. But Plato tells us, though, people are like dirt. They can either nourish you and help you grow as a person, or they can stunt your growth and make you wilt and die. So is that what you're talking about here, then, that the benefit of the of brethren around us can either nurture and help us grow or stunt our growth and we will wilt? How do I know? Well, the key is to keep company only with people who uplift you, whose presence calls forth your best. Well, there's Epictetus again. Well, I get that. So if I keep saying that I want to, if I'm asking myself here, Epictetus, what is a Freemason? Putting a person into a suit doesn't seem to make him a Freemason then. having a person memorize ritual that really doesn't understand anything about it, I don't see how that makes anybody any better. Or is it that this is like a pastiche? It's like the background on paintings and props on a big theater stage. Are you saying those are the props that are important, not to be distracted from the work, the intellectual, the work of the mind, but to those are just props in the background, and to pull back and take a look at the effect of all the props? When I sit and look at an opera, I don't think about the character of each one of the persons in the chorus, although they're humans in their own right. And they may be very fine, or they may be scoundrels. They're just not even primary to the score or to the way they interpret the libretto. So is that what you're saying to me? That this in the background can be people that nurture me, that we are all like dirt, people that can inspire? Yeah. But they can also, if I get distracted, are you saying to me that if I get distracted by examining the character and looking at the, and realizing the disappointment, and that I act emotionally, I don't control my emotion, that I act rashly, that it's going to come back to haunt me? That's what you seem to be saying. Then Plato comes along and says to me, Dale, nothing in the affairs of men is worthy of great anxiety. That's easy for you to say, Plato. Is it? Look what they did to me. Good point. But it was a jury of what, 6,000 of your peers, so-called peers, we use that loosely today, in a courtroom, a court area, the agora, that was just chaos. I don't know how anybody could claim that justice had been done. Well, Dale, think about what happened 6 years after my death. Well, they didn't even have the courage to kill you. They got you to kill yourself. And then 6 years later, they were building monuments and statues in your honor after they've realized what they had lost, what they had done. Good people do not need laws to tell them to act responsibly, while bad people will always find a way around the laws. Plato, you're right. But you're not the first person to say that to me. First person to ever say that to me was when I was perhaps 8 years old. That was something that Cyril told me. Well, I'll leave it at that. I'll come back and have a talk with you boys. And remember, says Plato, every heart sings a song incomplete until another heart whispers back. Those who wish to sing always find a song. At the touch of a lover, everyone becomes a poet. pay attention now. Oh, yes, we all have to. It's Aristotle's turn to talk. What do you got to say? We are what we repeatedly do. Excellence, then, is not an act, but a habit. And there you go. Just when I think I've figured out what being a Freemason is about, then I have to listen to these. And then I stop and start. I listen to the Greek philosophers. And then those little voices in my head. And they're always present. So it's a habit. There. I've become full circle. So the Freemasonry is a habit. It's not like I get every gesture perfect, but that I keep trying to make every gesture perfect. The only way isn't that everything I do should be perfect, but that the effort to perfection, perfection is, I just think, a state of mind. A state of mind that you're always inclined to improve in some way. But it's so tedious to hear these folks and some of this pop psych nonsense that you can wish things into being. Just wish it and there it will be. Well, I'm pretty damn sure the men in the trenches in the First World War were wishing their hearts out. A little bit of reality. Here, a little more? A little more reality for you? I like that. I like a little bit of reality every now and then, but not all the time. Not all the time. It's just, it can get a bit tedious, you know? Lessons we learn, eh? What are the lessons we learn? Here's a little piece about the lost key. Lost key. What are the work of the Entered Apprentice? Well, this guy makes me stop and think a little bit. And I think that's sort of wonderful. You get in this sort of frame of mind where, you know, I sit with some wonderful Masons. And it's like rank and privilege doesn't matter. The conversation is so enriched. It sparkles. It sparkles. Oh, yes, we have the odd one that likes to dress up in all its finery and make some feel. Well, we all, you know, you all like to be acknowledged, but when all of that stuff stops and the dust settles, then, as Peggy Lee would say, is that all there is? The lost key of the Entered Apprentice is service. There's a secret. Don't want anyone in the world to know that one, do we? Thank you, Edward Snowden. Snowden is bringing up things that we already knew. Unless we're able to fight for our freedom, we can't assume that it's there. Unless you're ready to do that, oh, just shrug and let it be taken and stripped away until it goes on too far. Because history, if it's taught us nothing else, is that authority, people with a little bit of authority always, always, always become overbearing unless they're kept in check. And that part, that last part, is our job. Oh, look, don't take my word for it. I live in a world of experts. Everybody's an expert. What do I know? I'm just I was born when I was a baby. I was a farm kid. Prince of Rhode Island. What do I know? I know that it takes hard work to get where you are. The lost key of the Entered Apprentice is service. Why, he may not ask. Not to him to ask. This gets very zen-like to me here. When he does not know. When you do, he does not know, he has no right to ask. His work is to do. To act, to express himself in some way, constructively if possible, but destructively rather than not at all. To act. Don't be claiming that perfection is going to be pouring out of your orifices. It's more important for you to act and express yourself in some way than not at all. And not to ask, because you have no idea. You're clueless. We are clueless. The Entered Apprentice is, without action, he loses his great work. Without tools, which symbolize the body, he cannot act in an organized manner. Consequently, it is necessary to master the arts and sciences, which place in his hands intelligent tools for the expression of energy. Beauty is the keynote to his ideal. Ah. With his concrete ideals, he must beautify all with which he comes in contact so that the works of his hand may be acceptable in the eyes of the great architect of the universe. His daily life in home, business, and society, together with the realization of the fundamental unity of all, of each, form the base upon which the aspiring candidate may rise a great superstructure. In truth, he must live the life, the result of which is the purification of his body, so that the more attenuated forces of the higher degrees may express themselves through the finer sensitivity of the receiving pole within himself. When he reaches this stage in his growth, he is spiritually worthy to consider advancement into a higher degree. Wow. So what are you saying here, Manly? You saying we have no business making that decision for a fellow? That the lodge is ready to bring him to the next degree? Or what are you saying, that it's not our choice at all? You're pointing out that we've made a serious mistake? A mistake? Well, or are you pointing out that it's better for us as entered apprentices to act destructively or constructively than not to act at all? Are you really saying that we've not advanced beyond the stage of an entered apprentice? Well, at least I know. If I agree with your thinking, at least I know. At least when I look in the mirror, there's no delusions. At least I have a sense of how I sound and how I look objectively. What can I say to you? Nobody told me at the time that the master craftsmen around me weren't so skillful. What happened to the skills? I'm not to ask questions because I don't have the knowledge. Got it. Got it. Well, Manly, I think I'm going to come back to you. I think you and I have a lot to talk about. Well, let me wrap this up today. Honestly, if I go on any longer, I'll be slapping myself silly, you know? It's just one of those days. Here, everything's starting to bear fruit and seed, and the season of renewal is going on, and what do you got? What could be better? I mean, we live in such a, you know, a gifted area, a part of the world, but this didn't come as a gift, sugar-coated and wrapped with a ribbon. Sure it didn't. Surely didn't. Ah, man. I hope you'll come back. I hope you've liked the show. I really do. And I hope we get a chance to do this again. Next week. Hey, we're coming up to Labor Day soon in Canada. See ya. Thanks for joining. Commit those acts of random Masonic kindness. Here's a little Greek ancient music.